And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Jean Canel Stevens. Today I'll be reading from the book 100 Favorite Folk Tales, compiled by Sif Thompson. Maid Lena. Once upon a time, there was a farmer who had three sons. The eldest was called Peter, the second Paul, and the third Espen. Now Peter and Paul were a couple of strong, wide-awake lads. They could hear and see and laugh and play and sew and weep, so they were very useful to their father. But the youngest was a poor sort of do-nothing fellow. He never had a word to say, but went mooning about like one in a dream, or sat over the fire and waked up the ashes, and so they called him Espen Asterisk. The farm stood amid fertile fields and fair green meadows, but in their midst lay a tract of barren, worthless moorland, strewn over with stones and overgrown with heather. Here Espen loved to lie asleep and dreaming, staring up at the sky. Peter and Paul, however, could not bear to see that bit of waste land, so their father gave them leave to see what they could do with it. True, there was an old story about the land belonging to the fairies, but of course that was all nonsense. So Peter and Paul set to work with a will. They dug up all the stones and put them in a heap on one side, and they plowed and sowed their new field. They sowed it with wheat, and it did well all through the winter, and in the spring gave promise of a splendid crop. Not one of their other fields looked half so well, until Midsummer Eve, when there came a sudden end to all their satisfaction, for on Midsummer Eve the whole crop was utterly destroyed. The entire field looked as if it had been trodden underfoot. Every blade of wheat was so crushed and beaten down that it could never recover or lift itself up again. No one could understand how such a thing had happened, so there remained nothing to do but plow the field afresh and let the grass grow. Next spring, there was finer and better grass there than in any of their meadows, but just the same thing happened again. On Midsummer Eve, all the grass was trodden down and beaten out as if with a flail, so they got no profit out of the field that year. Then they plowed it once more, let it lie fallow through the winter, and in the spring sowed their field with flax. It came up beautifully, and before Midsummer Eve was in full flower. It was a pretty sight, and Peter and Paul surveyed it with pride and joy. But remembering what had taken place the two former years, they agreed that one of them should keep watch there on Midsummer Eve. Peter, as the eldest, wished to undertake this duty. So arming himself with a stout cudgel, he sat down on the great bank of stones he had helped to pile up when they cleared the land. It was a beautifully mild evening, clear and still. Peter quite meant to keep wide awake. For all that, however, he fell asleep and never woke till midnight, when there came a fearful rustling and roaring overhead that made the ground beneath him shake and tremble. And when he tried to look about him, the whole sky was pitchy black. But in the midst of it all, they shone something red that looked like a fiery dragon, and the whole field seemed to roll from side to side, till he began to feel as if he were being tossed in a blanket. And there was such a roaring and buzzing in his ears that at last he became completely dazed. He could not bear it any longer, but was glad enough to escape with a whole skin and get safely home. Next day the flax lay there, trodden down and beaten out, till the whole field looked as smooth and bare as a deal board. So after that, neither Peter nor Paul cared to bestow any more labor upon the land, and the next spring the whole place was overgrown with grass and wildflowers. There were white lady smocks, blue cornflowers, and scarlet poppies. The heather, too, came creeping and peeping up everywhere amongst the stones and flowers. For while the brothers were working away so hard with plow and harrow, the heather had lain snugly beneath in little nooks and crannies. And now nobody troubled himself any further about the field, except Espen, who liked it far better this year than he had done the three previous summers, and he used to go there oftener than ever, and lies staring up at the blue sky. Late on Midsummer Eve, he slipped out of the house, after having slept most of the day, for he meant to keep watch all that night. He wanted to know what it was that went on there every Midsummer Eve, and whether it was the work of fairy folk or other folk. Close to the heap of stones, there stood a tall tree, an old ash that had stood there many hundred years. Eskin climbed up into this tree, sat very still, and kept wide awake till midnight. And he too heard a roaring and a rushing that seemed to fill the air, and he too saw the sky grow dark as if a carpet was spread out over it. And out of the black sky he saw a red gleam come. It came nearer and nearer until it took the form of a fiery dragon with three heads and three long necks. As the dragon drew near, the storm increased, and the whirlwind went round and round the field, until each single blade and stalk lay there crushed and ground down, as if it had been trampled underfoot. The old ash tree lashed about him with its branches, while its aged trunk swayed to and fro so violently that Edson had to hold on tight, lest the whirlwind should blow him away. But all at once, it grew quite still and quiet, and the sky was clear again, and instead of a dragon with three heads, Eskin now saw what looked like three large swans. But as they came nearer, he saw that they were three young girls, partly disguised in the form and plumage of swans, with great white wings and long flowing veils. And they sank slowly down through the air to the foot of the old ash where Eskin was. Then they cast aside their feathery disguise. The wings folded themselves together, and there at the foot of the tree lay three white veils as fine as cobwebs. They themselves, however, rose and danced, hand in hand, round and round the field, singing all the while. Never had Eskin heard anything so enchanting. Never had he seen anything so beautiful as these young girls in their white robes and with golden crowns upon their heads. For a long time he was afraid to move, lest he should frighten them away. But at length he slipped softly down, picked up the three white veils, and climbed as noiselessly up again. The three swan princesses had not noticed anything, but went on dancing round and round the meadow until 3 hours after midnight. Then they came back to the tree and wanted to put on their veils again, but there were no veils to be found. They ran about looking and looking, till at last they saw Eskin up in the tree. They spoke to him and said they were sure he had taken their veils. Yes, Eskin told them he had them. Then they entreated him to let them have them again, or they should be utterly ruined, they said. And they wept and implored, and promised to give him so much money for the veils that he would be richer than any king in the land. Eskin sat and gazed at them. How beautiful they were. So he told them they should not have their veils unless one of them would consent to be his wife. Ah, no, said one. Certainly not, cried the second. But the third and youngest princess said, yes, only bring us our veils. Eskin gave the other two their veils, but refused to let the third have hers until she gave him her hand and a kiss and put a ring on his finger, and promised to come and be married to him next Midsummer Eve. We are three sisters, answered the princess, and were brought up in a castle that used to stand on this very spot. But a long, long time ago, we were carried off by a wicked fairy who kept us imprisoned 10,000 miles from here, and only on Midsummer Eve are we allowed to revisit our old home. Now you must build a castle on this very spot, where our marriage also can take place, and everything must be arranged on a princely scale. You may invite as many guests as you please, only not the king of the land. You shall not lack money. Break off a twig from the ash tree you climbed, strike the largest of the stones lying at a tree, and say, for Maid Lena. The stone will roll back, and under it you will find all that you may require. You can open and shut your treasure house as often as you like to repeat these words, and with the stroke of the ash tree. You can open and shut your treasure house as often as you like to repeat these words with the stroke of the ash tree. And so, farewell till then, she said. And she wound her veil about her head, as her sisters had already done. And it spread out like two white wings, and all three princesses flew away. At first they looked like three white swans, but they rose higher and higher till they were nothing but little white specks. And then they were lost to sight, and at the same moment the first ray of sunlight fell across the field. For a long time Espen stood gazing after them, quite stunned with all that he had seen and heard. At last he roused himself, tore a twig from the ash tree, and struck the stone with the words, "For Maid Luna." Immediately the stone rolled back, and beneath it was the entrance to a royal treasure house, full of silver and gold, and precious stones, and costly jewels, and goblets, and dishes, and candelabra, all of the most artistic form and design. In short, everything was there that could adorn a king's table. Espen took as many gold and silver coins as he could carry, struck the stone again, repeating the same words, and then went back to the farm. His father and brothers hardly knew him again. He wasn't like the same man. He walked with head erect, his hair was thrown back from his forehead, his eyes were shining, and he looked full of life and energy. Then he told them he knew now who it was that had destroyed their harvest the 3 previous summers. That piece of land was not to be cultivated, but he intended building a castle there, and there his wedding was to take place next Midsummer Eve. At first they thought that he had lost his wits, but when they saw all the silver and gold he had brought with them, they changed their opinion and let him give what orders he pleased. It now began a busy time, the like of which was never seen, with axe and saw, and hammer and plane, and lime and trowel, so that on Midsummer Eve the castle stood complete, with tower and turret, and roof and pinnacle all glittering with gold. Now it so happened that just before Midsummer Eve, after all the invitations were out, Espen's father and mother met the king, who had arranged a little trip into the country, and had contrived that his wife should take him past the castle of which he had heard so much. Of course, the farmer took off his hat to the king. He looked at his in return and said he had heard of the grand wedding that was being prepared for his youngest son, and added, "I should like to see him and his young bride." Well, the farmer did not see that he could do otherwise than say that they would feel it a great honor if the king would come to the wedding. So then the king thanked him and said that it would give him grand pleasure, and then he rode on. The wedding day came, and the guests came, and the king came too. Espen was there, but as yet no bride had appeared. People began to whisper that things were not quite right, that Espen's bride had come to him in a dream, and had vanished with the dream. About sunset, Espen went and stood in front of the castle, and gazed up into the air. "Oho," said folks, "so she is to come back, or is she?" And she is neither more nor less than one of the crazy fancies Espen's head is always full of. But Espen remained quite undisturbed. He had seen swans come flying through the air, and now he knew that she was near at hand. Directly afterwards, there came rolling up to the castle gate a magnificent golden chariot drawn by 6 white horses. Espen sprang to the carriage door, and there sat the bride, radiantly beautiful. But the first thing she said was, "Is the king come?" And Espen was obliged to say, "Yes, but he invited himself. We did not ask him." "That makes no difference," he said. "If I were to become a bride here today, the king would have to be the bridegroom, and it would cost you your life, which would make me most unhappy, for I wish to marry you and no one else. And now you will have to come to me if you can, and that before the year is out, or it will be too late. I live 10,000 miles from here, in a castle south of the sun, west of the moon, and in the center of the earth." When she had thus spoken, she drove off at a tremendous pace, and directly afterwards, Espen saw a flock of swans rise up in the air and disappear among the clouds. So he took his staff in his hand, left everything, and set off in his wanderings through the wide, wide world to seek and find his bride. He made straight for the south, and he wandered for days and for weeks, and wherever he came, he asked people if they knew the castle, but there was no one who had ever seen or heard the name. So at last, one day, out in the wood, he came upon 2 terribly grim-looking fellows fighting. Espen stopped and asked them what they were fighting about. They told them they were fighting for an old hat that was lying close by. The father was dead, and now they wanted to divide their inheritance, but the hat they could not divide. "Hat is not worth much," said Espen. But the dwarves said this hat was not like other hats, for it possessed this peculiarity. Whoever put it on became invisible, and so they both wanted to have it. and then they fell to again and fought and struggled. "Well, fight away till you are friends again," said Esmond, and he snatched up the hat, put it on his head, and went his way. When he had gone some little distance, he came upon two other dwarfs who were fighting savagely. They also wanted to divide their father's property, which consisted solely in a pair of boots. But whoever put them on went 100 miles with each step, for they both wanted them. Esmond got into conversation with them, and when he had learned the state of affairs, he advised them to run a race for the boots. "Now, I will throw the stone," said he, "and you must run after it, and whoever gets there first shall have the boots." This they agreed to, so Esmond threw the stone, and they set off running. Meanwhile, Esmond had put on the boots, and the first step carried him 100 miles away. Once again, he came upon two dwarfs quarreling over their inheritance, which could not be divided, and which both wanted to have. This was a rusty old cross-knife, but it possessed this virtue, they said. If you opened it and just pointed at anyone with it, they fell down dead, and then if you set it up again and touched them with it, they became alive again directly. "Let me look at the knife," said Esmond. "I shall be able to advise you, for I have settled such quarrels before." When he had got it, he wanted to prove it, and so he opened it, and then pointed it at the two dwarfs, who immediately fell down dead. "That's right," said Esmond. So he set up the knife and touched them with it, and they jumped up again directly. Esmond put the knife in his pocket and said goodbye, and then he put his hat on his head, and in another second was 100 miles away. He went on and on till evening, when he came to a little house that stood in the middle of a thick wood. A very old woman lived there. She was so old that she was all overgrown with moss. Esmond greeted her politely, and asked if she could tell him where the castle was that stood south of the sun, west of the moon, and in the center of the earth. "No," she said, "she'd never heard of such a castle, but she ruled over all the beasts of the field, and she could call them together and ask if any one of them knew." So she blew her whistle, and the wild beasts came gathering round them from all sides. They came running at full speed, all except the fox. He came sneaking behind in a very bad temper, for he was just going to catch a goose when he heard the whistle, and was obliged to come away and leave it. But neither the fox nor any one of the animals knew anything about the castle. "Well, then, you must go to my sister," said the old woman. "She rules over all the birds of the air. If she cannot help you, no one can. She lives 300 miles south of this, on the top of a high mountain. You cannot miss your way." So Esmond set off again, and soon came to the bird mountain. The old woman who lived there had never heard of the castle south of the sun, west of the moon, and in the center of the earth. But she whistled with her pipe, and all the birds came flocking from all four corners of the earth. She asked them if they knew the castle, but there was not one of them who had ever been so far. "Ah, but the old eagle is not here," she said, and whistled again. At last the old eagle came sailing heavily along, his wings whirring and whizzing, and he alighted on the top of a tree. "Where do you come from?" said the old woman. "You come too late. Your life must pay the forfeit." "I come from the castle south of the sun, west of the moon, and in the center of the earth," said the eagle. "I have a nest and young ones there, and I was obliged to see after them a little before I could leave them and fly so far away." The old woman answered that his life should be spared if he would conduct Esmond to the castle. The eagle thought he could manage that if he were allowed to stop and rest tonight. Next morning Esmond got up on the eagle's back, and the eagle flew away with him, high up in the air and far away over the stormy ocean. When they had gone a long, long way, the eagle said, "Do you see anything out yonder?" "I see something like a high black wall close upon us." "Ah, that is the earth. We have to go through that. Hold fast, for if you were to get killed, my life would have to pay the forfeit." So they flew straight into the pitch dark cave. Esmond held fast, and almost directly afterwards he saw daylight again. When they had gone a little farther, the eagle said again, "Do you see anything out yonder?" "I see something like a great glass mountain," said Esmond. "That is water," said the eagle. "We have to go through that. Hold fast, for if you were to get killed, my life would have to pay the forfeit." So they plunged right into the water and got safely through. Then they flew some distance through the air, and then the eagle said again, "Do you see anything out yonder?" "I only see flames of fire," said Osten. "We have to go through that," said the eagle. "Creep well under my feathers and hold fast, for if you should get killed, my life would have to pay the forfeit." So they flew straight into the fire, but they got safely through. Then the eagle sank slowly down and alighted on the land. "Now," he said, "I must rest a while, for we have 500 miles farther to go." "Ah, now I can carry you," said Osten. So he took the eagle on his back, and with five strides they were there. "Now we have come too far," said the eagle. "Can you step 10 miles backward?" "No, I can't do that," said Osten. "Then we must fly those 10 miles," said the eagle. So they arrived safe and sound at the castle south of the sun, west of the moon, and in the center of the earth. That was a castle, the like of which was not to be found in all the world. It shone from top to bottom like pure gold. When Osten came to the castle gate, he sat down, and presently a serving maid passed him on her way into the castle. He called to her, "Creeper's Lena," and begged her for a goblet of wine for a weary wayfarer. The girl brought the message to the princess, who ordered her own golden goblet to be filled with wine, and sent the girl out with it. When Osten had drunk the wine, he threw his ring into the goblet, the ring she had given them the day they first met. The princess recognized the ring directly, so she ran down and embraced Osten and led him into the castle. "Now I have got you, I must let you go again directly," she said, "and you must journey all the long way back in my swan guard, for if the witch who has enchanted us should catch sight of you, she would change you into stone with a single glance." "There is a remedy for that," said Osten, "only take me to her." So Osten put on his invisible hat, took his knife in his hand, and went up to the old witch, and just pointed at her, and she fell down dead. So he had her buried 40 fathoms underground, and then he married his princess, and he is married to her still. You've been listening to a story from the book 100 Favorite Folk Tales, compiled by Skip Thompson, published by the Indiana University Press. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. The executive producer is Carla Canella, and I'm Jean Canell Stevens. Thank you.